So I wanted to take about an hour of your lives that you unfortunately never get back and talk a little bit about building very large services in the cloud. This is not specific to Azure, though I will tend to use Azure as the example. This could be Amazon or Rackspace or your own data center. The same approaches generally apply. So we'll talk about large-scale services, keeping the lights on, keeping them running, and I'll share anecdotes in as candid a form as legal will let me about some of the really interesting things that we've seen happen when you put 20 million users on a website and kick it until it falls over. So a little bit about me and my role. I work on the Windows Azure Customer Advisory Team. It's part of core engineering. And we will go out and work on very large-scale projects, things that we haven't really done before. We're not entirely sure how it's going to work. Figure out how to make them work, figure out where they break, clean things up, get it running, and bring that knowledge back to engineering, as well as publish guidance about how to do certain things. Just a little housekeeping note, I'd like to keep this as interactive as possible. I will probably throw out a few completely outrageous statements just to see if people are paying attention. So please, if I do that, call me on it. If I don't, please ask questions. I encourage me to share kind of some more context and some more of the things that we've seen. All right, so I just want to set the stage a little bit and talk about kind of three pillars, kind of this iron triangle. Folks familiar with CAP theorem, Brewer's theorem? A couple hands in the room. So basically, it talks about there's no such thing as a free lunch. There's certain physical constraints when you're doing any kind of large-scale system. If you in CAP theory, we talk about balancing partitionality, availability, and data consistency. If I was going to give a talk about how to design very large-scale, stateful data management solutions, we'd spend a lot of time talking about that. Instead, I want to talk about building services. And when we think about services, I really only think about three things. I think about the scalability of a service. How much work can I put through it? I think about the availability. Can I keep the lights on? And I think about insight in that, do I know what the service is doing? And if I don't have all of these, I don't really have a successful service. If I have a service that has 100% uptime but can serve three people, probably not worth building. If I have a service that can serve 100 million people concurrently for 3 minutes a day, also not very useful. But the one that tends not to get a lot of attention, the one that tends not to be first and foremost, is insight. What is the service doing? Can I manage it? Can I understand it? Is it healthy? And it's one that tends to get retrofitted on after you've had a few rather unpleasant experiences. So when I think about insight, I think about the third pillar of, do I actually know my system is working? More importantly, do I know the system is broken before my users do? So, kind of focus a lot around the availability parts of it, talk about how systems at scale fall over, how to design around it, and how to bake in the right degrees of telemetry. So just kind of a quick question to understand the room. Folks in the room that have deployed public-facing internet services. Okay, a lot of hands, that's good. Folks that are going to. Okay, a few hands, okay. So I think we got a pretty good audience for this stuff. So I'm just going to go through a little bit about the common patterns of architecture and the ramifications, kind of the obvious and some of the more subtle ones in terms of how we design and build software. So let's talk about what availability really means. We want to maximize service availability. We want to make sure that when someone comes to consume the service, to receive value from the software that we create, that it's there, that it's accessible and usable. Failures are going to happen. This is an iron law. If you have enough moving parts and enough time and pressure, something will tip over. So when it does, we can't pretend it's not going to happen. Instead, we need to think about how do we minimize the impact? How do we degrade gracefully? How do we isolate faults? And then how do we fall back to some other mechanism? Be it another service, another data center, another deployment. And finally, how do we maximize performance and capacity? Services that are live, again, as I was saying earlier, that can't handle the load that we want to put off them, they're not actually doing us that much good. So we'll kind of meander through some of these things and really what they mean in terms of how we design and how we build. So who has a service that looks like this? You've got a load balancer, you've got some web services, you've got some app tier stuff. Pretty standard end tier architecture. Anyone got one of these? Yeah, that's what I thought. So We've heard a lot over the last decade about make everything stateless. Folks heard that? A few nods? Come on, everyone's heard the, yes, make everything stateless. I'm not going to go and call that a fallacy. I'm going to say that it is an imprecise term. So let's dig in a little bit, and let's really kind of think about, when I say make everything stateless, what do I really mean? Because if an application contains zero state, it's not really doing anything useful. So what we're really talking about is externalization of state. We're going to take logic and state. We're going to pull them apart. We're going to put logic in stateless containers that can fault, and it can be easily replaced. We're going to put the state into specialized containers that are responsible for partitionality, affinity, locality, availability, consistency, all those hard physics problems. For a very long period of time, probably about 20 years ago, or about a 20-year period of time, relational databases were the king of state management because they did what they did exceedingly well, and they did other things reasonably well. Folks using relational databases, I'm going to guess pretty much every hand is going to go up. Okay. And they're great. They're really, really powerful tools. But they don't do everything, especially in a services or a large-scale world. So we start to see other state stores coming online. Distributed caching, document databases, key value stores, big data, lots of other interesting things. So really the pattern is, in order to make my job as an application developer easy, I want to take all the really hard problems around maintaining state and maintaining consistency, and I want to devolve those to a specialized thing. I want to make it not my problem so I can deliver business value more quickly and more easily, and that I don't have to worry about what is the value of something and is it consistent, is it accessible, and what happens when something underneath it fails. So this has led to things like mirroring, log shipping, high availability, disaster recovery, using traditional database terms, that I'm going to take a bunch of little bitty application servers and scale them out, and I'm going to have one nice big database on the back end. I'm going to scale it up, and I'm going to make it highly available and highly resilient. And that's a pretty good way of doing things until you hit internet scale. If I need, at a certain point, the cost of buying a scale-up box is going to get prohibitive. And my team works on some of the largest on-premise scale-up database installations in the world. And you can do these things. But there's a point at which it gets very expensive, and then there's a point past which you just can't buy a bigger box. Or the point at which a scale-up box is actually a distributed system and you have all the same problems. There's one other thing that we're starting to see as we move into this world of cloud services. In this world, I own all these pieces. They're all mine. I built them, I designed them, I spec'd them, I roll them out. That's great. But what if I need more services? What if I need specialized things that I don't want to pay the cost, either in time or in resources, of maintaining them? So here's the other trend we see a lot of, in that now my application is not an island anymore. I'm taking hard dependencies on external services in order to deliver value. I may have SendGrid for sending email because I don't want to maintain a bunch of mail servers. I may pull in Twitter feeds for and Facebook authentication for social interaction. So all of a sudden, I own a bunch of things, and then I take dependencies on things that are just an endpoint with an SLA. I'm trading time to market and agility for control. This has a very interesting outcome in that all of a sudden, this stuff's not mine. I have limited visibility and limited control. And I also have to trust the contract. Is anyone, folks using any kind of external internet-facing services in their own applications? A few hands. So 100% uptime, 100% SLA, never any bugs. That's what I thought. And again, I'll call us out. I'll call every vendor out as there's friction. We're trying to accelerate. These folks are trying to accelerate. Everyone's trying to build stuff on a continuous schedule. And that occasionally creates some friction. So these are the general set of patterns around externalization of state. If we were here in 12 months and I was talking, I'd actually be able to talk about things where we look at it and go, okay, we spent the last 10 years teasing state and logic apart. And that works pretty well. But for a certain class of very stateful, very interactive applications, it tends not to work very well. Because what I didn't draw here, physics. It takes time to shuttle bits. Electrons have mass. To shuttle bits from the load balancer to web servers to app servers, doing full protocol translations at every point in time. For most applications that are not heavily latency sensitive, this is okay. We trade speed for simplicity. It's the right balance. If I was building an interactive experience, a game server, these sorts of things, this would not be a good architecture because it takes too much time to move bits. So we're also seeing kind of an interesting trend back towards internalizing state, in that state and logic living together in that middle tier. If anyone familiar with the actor pattern, actor model implementations? A couple of nods. Not going to go too deep into it because it's still fairly nascent. We don't have a lot of customer evidence about this yet. But we're starting. This is one way. It's a very proven way. It's a very widespread way of building applications. There are other ones coming, but I won't delve too much into those. Okay, so let's talk about workloads. Who's seen something that looks like this? Everybody's seen something that looks like this. Who's been responsible for something like this? I have, totally, absolutely. No, only a mild degree of shame will I admit this. So there's an interesting pattern going on here when we see something like, hey, a underlying component has failed, I'm taking my ball, I'm going home. So, what is it? Without the relational database, which is an external service to your web app, the application cannot fulfill any workloads. Okay, so single point of failure, and the application is written in such a way that it assumes the database can never fail. Otherwise, why would we get an error message that says, I can't do anything? So let's think about that. Database vendors have done such a good job over the last decade that we have a generation of programmers that is unable to conceive of a world where a database failing or being unavailable is an unnatural condition. On one hand, that's amazing. That's really cool. And then on the flip side, it's like, as we move into a cloud world, as we move into decentralized services, there's some bad habits that have crept in by the fact that we were building on titanium eggshells. What's the other one? You said, in this world, in the world of cloud, in the world of services, in the world of composition, a database, like any other external state store, is an external service that's subject to partial availability. That might be 99.999, but there's still a time and a chance in which that thing that you depend on is offline. So we're going to take a bit of time and talk about how we structure these kinds of applications that depend on external services, the areas of failure, and how we work around them. Seem like a reasonable way to spend the next 30, 40 minutes? Or are everyone going, what is he talking about? Okay, so let's talk about designing for failure. So earlier when I brought up that little, hey, everything's broken, the inherent assumption was that the application only has one workload and it's completely dependent on the relational database. But most apps don't work like that. Most apps have different workloads that have different value, both to you and to your customers. So if we think about an application as a collection of workloads, we can then tease them apart and assign different value and different remediation to each of them. We can say that I manage not a globally coherent app, but I manage a set of work streams that deliver value. And when I decompose them and I identify what are the things that my application actually does and what are the most important ones, this allows me to split the difference. Let's take an e-commerce site. So what can I do? I can browse products, and I can buy products, and I can maybe search for products, and I can get recommendations. Just four simple work streams. They have different value. If I can't search and I can't buy, I can't make money. Sorry, if I can't browse and I can't buy, I can't make money. If I can't search, well, okay, it's a little annoying, and I've degraded my user experience, but I haven't cut it off. And if I can't get recommendations, again, I've degraded the user experience, but as long as I can still let somebody buy. So instead, if I think my application is those workloads, and I go, okay, I'm going to focus on making the browsing and the buying experience completely bulletproof. But if search goes offline for 5 or 10 minutes every month, it's not the end of the world. As long as I don't put up a, I can't connect to the database, I'm going home message. So this is where we think about this decomposition in the workloads. But more importantly, let's understand what the nines really mean. We hear a lot about nines in terms of, hey, we need 5 nines, we need 4 nines, we need this, we need that. Let's think about what it really breaks down into in terms of balancing how much downtime or how much unavailability can my business sustain versus how much do I want to invest to get there. If I was racking hardware and building software from scratch, I've worked in the telecom industry where 6 nines was kind of the gold standard. And it was incredibly expensive to get there in terms of purpose-built processors, runbooks this thick in terms of the 14 forms and sign-offs you needed to open a door. So again, there's always trade-offs. So let's think about whether this is Amazon or Azure. The numbers are largely the same because we're all dealing with the same physics. So let's talk about rolling out a service on Azure. I'm going to say that, all right, I get 99.95% external connectivity, being that we guarantee that your application or your deployed service should be connectable, available for or offline for no more than 10 minutes a month. Now, if we fail that, we'll give you your money. We'll give you some money back. But this is the availability target that we shoot for, and that seems pretty reasonable. Okay, three nines for a relatively cheap infrastructure built on commodity hardware. That sounds like a pretty good place to start. But let's flip that back around and really think about, we're building composed services that consist of multiple tiers, multiple components, multiple services, some of which are internal, some of which are external. So let's take a basic application. Say we have 5 services that are deployed together that make up the value that I deliver to customers. What's the composite SLA? Exactly. The more moving parts I have, the lower. No, that ain't right. The more moving parts I have, the lower my aggregate failure. So flipping back, this has a couple of interesting permutations. The first is, I want to design my application as a set of composed services for agility and time to market, so that I can evolve things independently and get them up quickly. But the more moving parts I have, the more likely I am to experience a failure. Okay, that seems like an interesting tug of war. The other piece of this that's really fascinating is, what happens when I have a failure? And this is really where I want to talk about the, how do I isolate faults and how do I isolate things? So let's think about a sports site. Let's say that we're shooting for 4 nines. I'm ESPN, for example, and I want to have a 4 nines availability. But at the same time, I hardly have 2 things that going on. I have live scores and commentary, and I have team statistics, because people like statistics about sports. I don't follow them, I don't really get it, but hey, I don't have to understand business models in order to design for them. So let's say that for my live scores and commentary, this is why people buy subscriptions to my service. This is where they spend impressions and eyeballs. And during a game, I absolutely must have 100% availability. Games generally follow the sun. In a given geography, there will be between 9 and 9. And when there's no game on, I don't care. I can turn that service off. I can delete it. It's not important anymore. So all of a sudden, it jumps out, okay, I've got a workload that needs to be incredibly available at a certain period of time. And when it's not a game in session, it's actually irrelevant. And stats, 1% of the time, half an hour, a month, that can be offline, and that's okay. So when it comes to the design and the architecture, it really comes down to, I don't want cross dependencies between how I deliver live scores and deliver stats. I don't want a failure in an underlying component rippling through. Everything from something as simple as, don't serve these out of the same database, all the way down to, how do you ensure that you have redundant capacity and redundant platforms deployed for both. So really, this comes down to understanding your business model, understanding the pieces of it, and where the value is driven from. So let's get a little less philosophical, and let's kind of get down into the weeds a little bit, because I'm talking up here. Let's get down to the coding level, slowly. Okay, so with enough scale, enough time, enough pressure, every single thing will fail. I have seen and every platform I've worked on, whether I was buying my own hardware, working on Amazon, working on Azure, I have seen things that should not have been able to fail. Most modern applications don't have a single failure mode. They tend to have this confluence of events. This goes wrong at the same time, this went wrong at the same time, somebody was updating something, and it all comes together into a perfect storm, which is why failure analysis can get a little tricky. really comes down to when you design and when you code, how is your application going to behave when the unexpected occurs? There's really only two options. It will either gracefully handle the fact that something it depends on is doing some very strange things, or not so gracefully. And this is a design decision. You may go, hey, this is an unimportant, this is a beta, this is something else. I'm not going to bother with graceful error degradation yet. Or you may go, this is a mission-critical service, and the CEO is going to be on my desk with a hammer if we have even a minute of public downtime. Again, it's a business decision that leads down into technical choices. And really, there's kind of two faults that we need to think about. Transient faults, self-healing, temporary service interruption. I have a service which pulls down a Twitter feed to expose on my site. Transient failure. I get throttled. I've exceeded my capacity. Okay. I want the system to handle that automatically. I want it to back off. I want it to cache data. I want it to be stale for a few minutes until the feed comes up again. Should be auto-healing and mostly transparent to the user. So if that Twitter feed is 30 seconds out of date or 2 minutes out of date, depending on what I'm doing, it might be relevant, it might not be, but at least I'm still delivering a value. The one that's a little trickier is an enduring failure, something that requires manual intervention, either through an external monitoring or kind of an Oracle service, or through an organic component, much like us in the room, to go and resolve something. Talk about the transient failures first. All right. So, failures. Normally we think about failures at a node level. As software developers, this is the boundary of my existence. I'm going to write code, I'm writing to the process boundary. I can have connectivity issues, transient failures, hardware failures, stuff can tip over. When you're running in an environment with 1,000 machines, 10,000 machines, 100,000 machines, something is always failing. So we need to be prepared for that. Entire services might fail. Service dependencies, either my own, external, can tip over, almost always through configuration and code issues. I'll share a few stories in a minute about, we talk about likelihood and kind of the failure modes that tend to be the most crippling, and it's usually the organic ones that break down first. And of course, entire regions can go unavailable. Hurricane Sandy comes on board, wipes out an entire area's worth of data centers. Not necessarily taking the data centers inherently offline, not necessarily destroying them, but dropping network connectivity. A data center you can't get to, it's just as well it wasn't there. Okay, so let's talk about transient failures. So SQL Azure, anyone using SQL Azure? Oh, sorry, Windows Azure SQL Database. The marketing folks keep telling me to change that. So SQL Azure is a database as a service. And it does a lot of really interesting things. You get failover, a high availability, multiple copies of your data for free just by going create database. When Scott created that database earlier, that included all of that uptime capability. The challenge that comes into is that's a, by default, that's a shared environment. That is the you're in the jungle with everybody else. And you get a set amount of resources. So when the system runs out of resources, it says, hey, hold on. I need you to come back later. I'm too busy right now. It enforces admission control. So if you're working against SQL Azure, your code needs to be prepared for the fact that you can get throttled out. I mean, this will happen to an on-premise SQL server as well. It'll just manifest differently. And usually the answer is throw so much hardware at it in terms of capital expense, developers aren't even aware that they're doing bad things. When we move to the cloud, we move to composing services. As developers, it's our problem. It's our responsibility to do the right thing. Now, luckily, the PMP folks have released something called the Transient Fault Handling Library. Anyone using that? Recommend getting familiar with it. Basically, it's a way of saying, listen, I'm going to work with a bunch of external services. They're going to have failure modes. I want a policy-driven way of responding. So in this case, I'm going to set up a connection to SQL Azure, and I want to say, hey, if it fails because of a transient, database was failing over to another server. There wasn't enough resources. It was throttled out. That's okay. I want you to wait 5 seconds and then retry and do that 3 times. Policy-driven, injected externally, not something I have to bake in, other than saying using either a reliable SQL connection or a retry handler. So if I have this piece of code in, if I've wrapped and I've wrapped my external calls appropriately, I can have a transient failure and it's transparent to the application. I'm not going to get a weird exception. It'll just keep going. I may log that I had to retry a little bit. That could tell me I'm running a database too hot, but that's okay. But as with everything else, there's no such thing as a free lunch. Every time you make it, you get something, you're giving up something somewhere else, whether it's complexity, cost, availability. So this is perfectly correct code, but it doesn't have any context. Who can tell me what's wrong with this piece of code? Okay, so I'm going to tease that apart. This statement could potentially take a very long time. Absolutely. It will not execute three times. This is being done, this is still transactional code. So the first time, if it executes, the transaction completes, I get a notification and I go through. So it's not worried about item potency, but what I am worried about is this potentially taking a long time. What context is this running on? ASP.NET developers in the room? Okay, a few. This is running in the synchronous command handler of an ASP.NET page. You absolutely could end up with an experience that looks a lot like this. Who's been in the line at the airport with behind the person who doesn't know how to work the ticket machine? Everybody. Or the grocery store with the person paying for like 6,000 items and they don't have barcodes in any of them. Most web servers by default implement a queuing mechanism. IIS absolutely does this, in that as requests come in, they're thrown into a queue, and a set number of dispatch threads are allocated to pull work out and then execute it. So essentially, throughput and latency are linked by the depth, actually by the width of the dispatch queue. By default, in IIS, it's 12 times the number of cores available. So if I roll out a large Azure VM, I get 48 dispatch threads. So if I have a long-running synchronous activity dispatched onto one of those threads, I block it, just like the person at the grocery store. And this happens. This is an anonymized bit of data from a production site with 30 million users. It wasn't a database call. It was actually a web service call out to a third-party moderation service. So if you're going to be accepting user input and you have children on your site, depending on the geography that you're in, you've got to moderate it. You've got to make sure that people aren't putting questionable content out there. That's an expensive thing to do in-house. So generally, you'll go and you'll find a service that you can push stuff out to and get back a, this is good, this is not so good. Compositional service, time to market, works really well, except for when that service you depend on breaks its SLA. In this particular case, the service came with a nice little client proxy. It just says, give it a server name, put your stuff here, and magic happens. Oh, and there's a timeout value. The timeout value was not honored. Basically, you set timeout 1 second. If you're looking at the values, that's about 4.5 minutes that call would just be sitting there, hanging. This particular path through the system was only called in 0.5% of all calls into the service. But like anything that blocks a queue, it doesn't take very many. And it's a cascading failure. So you get one, no big deal. You get two, it's kind of bad. You get four, and once you choke that pipe, everything starts backing up. The time range on the bottom, though thoroughly anonymized, is 2.5 minutes. One unbounded external service call on a code path that was called 0.5% of the time brought down a production site for 30 million users in less than 5 minutes. I find this a little terrifying myself. So, kind of the takeaways here. There are some anti-patterns. You cannot trust downstream services. Even if you control them, your code needs to say, I don't trust you, I'm bounding my call. If you break the contract, you take too long, you don't come back quickly, you come back with gibberish, I'm going to ignore you and I'm going to keep going. I'm going to go to my failure, to my remediation path in code. Again, not bounding non-deterministic calls. Has anybody used HTTP client, the .NET 4.0 and below? Web client. Couple hands. there is a live lock in web client under heavy load. Even if you're using it asynchronously, what happens is on the response handler, it actually does an authentication check. Since authentication updates needs to be an atomic swap, you pass through a monitor. And a monitor is relatively cheap unless you're hitting it 2,000 or 3,000 times a second. Same effect. It's a global choke point per app domain. So you look at it and you go, I'm using asynchronous code. I'm doing the right thing. But all of a sudden, your load goes up, and all of a sudden you see this huge unbounded spike in response time. And you're going, what did I do? I did everything right. But there are occasionally landmines in code, even stuff that we ship in the framework, that shows up under load. So it's again, it's one of these. Sometimes when you're going out of process, when you're going across the network, when you're going out of machine, there's a lot of physics involved and a lot can go wrong. Don't trust it inherently. The other one is default asynchronous. Folks using .NET 4.5 yet? You guys rock, because I've been programming in .NET for about 11 years now, since the early beta around 1.0. And I'm more jazzed about 4.5 than I am about anything else, because programming asynchronously is hard and it's ugly and it sucks until now. I'm not saying that everything is sweetness and light, but tasks, the whole task-based model has made this significantly simpler, as well as making what resource you're using for an asynchronous activity a lot easier to manage. So once you go to .NET 4.5, there is no excuse for using purely synchronous blocking operations. You still have to be careful, because there's still an underlying resource that you're burning, in this case the thread pool, but it makes code like this a lot harder to write. And it makes doing the right thing a lot easier. And I will freely admit, most of the time, up until the last couple of months, I have written synchronous code because it was simpler and I just had to get something working. I'm sure we've all been there. You've got a deadline, you just need to crank through stuff. But going forward, .NET 4.5, everything in the .NET framework has an async, a task-based async approach. And through use of await and async, you can make it look like synchronous code and not have to worry about all of the interesting things about swapping back and forth between synchronous and asynchronous code. So that's my free little tidbit, summed up as, you're going to need retry handlers. We're working with services to prevent transient faults. Default to asynchronous, and don't trust those downstream services too much. They will bite you when you least expect it. All right, just a quick note on retry policies. Different services and different experiences need different retry policies. Say, for example, if I'm rendering a web page. Now, when I say synchronous and asynchronous, it's actually, we end up with this weird split of, is it synchronous or asynchronous from the system perspective? And is the user interactively waiting for something to complete? Unfortunately, we've overloaded the terms, and it's important to tease them apart. From this perspective, the context is from the user. It's from the thing that's consuming my service and ultimately giving me money, or value in whatever kind of currency I take. So if I'm rendering a web page, people are lazy, they don't have a great infinite degree of patience, I count myself among them, I want to see things happen quickly. So if I'm calling out to a database and I want to shoot for a 200 millisecond end-to-end render time, any retry policy that takes me out past that is a bit of a problem. So what I might do is I might set up a policy that says, hey, my synchronous SQL retry handler does a fail fast, i.e. the first time I hit, if I get an error message, I immediately try again, and then I'll back off 50 milliseconds into 50 milliseconds. And if that fails completely, I'm done, I'm going to my fallback. Instead, if I'm doing task-based work, where I receive work, queue it, and deal with it later, and basically just tell the user, we've received your order, we'll get to it at some point, then I can have a much more rigorous back-off policy. Caching, again, similar types of policies, much smaller numbers, because I expect my cache to be more immediately available. So I'm going to pull in a little example from our friends at Netflix, where they have some, basically how they design their client to service, their service, their intrust service proxy libraries, is implemented basically using something they call a circuit breaker. So a request to a remote service times out, for whatever reason. There's many reasons this can happen. And that the resources allocated to that service dependency have been exhausted. And I, as a client library, I'm going to turf an exception going something is bad. So basically, in any of these cases, what I want to do is understand where's the danger zone? Where have I decided that this service is offline for a certain period of time? Now, the reason that we want to fall over, we want to pull the switch on a service dependency, is that assuming something is working and checking for it is expensive. It's time-consuming. It adds latency. It drains away resources. So the way that they've written a lot of their services is, for any of the error conditions or the error contexts, if the threshold over a period of time is breached, the switch is flipped. And the library that interacts with that service moves into a fallback mechanism. And depending on what it does, that can be a number of different fallback mechanisms. All right, so there we go. We can have a custom fallback. So say, for example, if my default is to pull from an external web service to get fresh information, I may fall back to locally cached data. I'll give you something. It'll be stale, but it's still good data. I may just come back with, I don't know, and then push the responsibility of giving a good experience to the user back to the upstream service. For inner services, things that kind of live down at the bottom of the stack, this is usually what you do. You push the responsibility of understanding context upstream and basically say, it's somebody else's problem. That's not a bad design. All the core Azure platform services do that because we don't understand what you're trying to deliver to the user sufficiently well to do the right thing. And the other one is just failing fast. Immediately throw back a 500, a 302, whatever the appropriate error message is going to be. But the interesting part about this design pattern is that it's encapsulated in the client proxy. So as a developer who's using that service, I don't have to worry about it. And this is another theme we see in terms of how you actually structure your code bases, is don't make your developers think. And I will freely admit to being a very lazy person that does not want to think when I am writing code. So if these orthogonal aspects, these crosscuts, are baked into your service proxies, people won't have to think about them. So if I'm responsible for developing the recommendation service, I should also be responsible for developing the client API for the recommendation service that does the right thing, as well as some of the telemetry aspects that we'll talk about in a little bit. I'm just going to skip through some failure mode definition stuff because it's kind of boring. Let's take some simple code. Everyone in the room, I'm sure, has written something that looks roughly like this. Let's just take a rough guess. How many ways can this fail? How many inherent dependencies on the right thing being in place, both statically and dynamically, does this very simple code have?
No real error recovery.
This code does not do the right thing. This is a bad example. This does not have a path for handling failure. I just wanted to throw it up as how many different ways can you actually get to an error condition in this code? Really, all this thing is saying is recovering from this is somebody else's problem, which may or may not be the right thing. It's something like this, it's probably not. All right, let's just have a peek at it. There are actually more. But failure points. Database server could be offline. Database might not exist. Table might not exist. Configuration might be wrong. Database server may not be responding for whatever reason. It could be offline for maintenance. I could have the wrong permissions. I might not have my security context set up properly. Because everyone just runs everything as SA, right? I hope you don't. I really hope. My indexes could be corrupt so that my queries could be completely unbounded and could take hours to come back. Configuration could be invalid, so my production site is pointed at a test database or vice versa. No one's ever done that, right? I have. Yeah. I have completely mixed up staging deployment environments and done phenomenal and interesting things. So we'll get back to operations in a second. And the number one leading cause of cloud service failures. We'll get to that shortly. But I want to tell a little story about unexpected limits. So it's about 6 or 8 months ago. We're going live in about, 5 days. And we're doing load testing. And all of a sudden, system drops. It is offline. It is broken. We cannot connect to our database service anymore. And we're thinking, well, at least it wasn't 5 days from now when we're live. But at the same time, please hand me the antacids. We have some stuff to debug. So let's think about a large-scale service. I've got 1,000 cores deployed. I've got 500 databases because I'm scaled out. I have a very large amount of data, and I need a lot of IOPS. And I'm deployed in Azure as a hosted service. All seems pretty reasonable thus far. And I don't have any affinity in my load balancer. So any user can come into any instance, which means that any instance can connect to any database. Well, doesn't seem unreasonable thus far. So in Azure, every hosted service has a single external VIP, or virtual IP. So that's its public IP address. And every database cluster, every logical server in a subscription, also has one IP address. Folks get where I'm going with this one? In an IPv4 routing table, what is the maximum number of entries between a fixed source and a dynamic port, a fixed destination, and port 1433? 65,000. You are precisely correct. All right, so I have opened up a huge number of connections. I have exceeded the size of the routing table. What happens next? The incoming load balancer goes, there are too many connections. I must keep this system alive. So I'm going to kill oldest, then newest connections, because that's my policy for handling throttling events. So I start chopping out the old ones. Okay, no big deal. I get a few application errors, but nothing outrageous. And then I start chopping the newest ones. Okay, this doesn't seem outrageous yet. This just seems like I might get a few more database errors. I might see a big spike in database errors. And then my transient, my fault handling code will simply back off, tell a few users to come back later. This doesn't seem terrible, except for one small thing. What does a very large number of partially open connections from the same source IP address look like? It looks like a denial of service attack. And then SQL Azure goes, hey, this IP address up here, it's attacking me, and I do not play that game. You, Mr. IP address, you are banned for 5 minutes. Out of the pool. And then we sat around and went, I think this is recorded, so I'm not going to say what we actually said. But we were less than impressed at the unexpected limit that we had run into. We hit the limits of physics. We hit the limits of IPv4. So not something that's going to happen very often. And like I said, you need to deploy a lot of infrastructure in order to do this. And there are ways around it. We've actually published some of them and are preparing to publish more of the code on exactly how to do very large scale, scale out relational database applications. But this is one where it was never just one failure mode. Four or five things all had to come together under intense pressure to cause the failure. This tends to be how systems fail, other than human error and human intervention. So with about 7 minutes left, let's just roll over and briefly talk about designing for operations. So who's played Frogger? All right, I'm in the right room. Last time I went and did this, everyone looked at me funny. I was like, wow, I'm way too old to be in the room. So Frogger, I need to get from A to B without getting run over. Sounds a lot like running a live site. So let's think about what Frogger would look like if we don't have good telemetry deployed. So who's lived in this world? Come on, I know there's people in the room. I am absolutely one of them. Running without insight, running without telemetry into the health and operation and behaviors of your system is like putting a blindfold on and running across I-5. You might get lucky, but if you don't, you will find out at the very last minute. So there's a set of recommendations and a set of patterns we generally have for what do you really need to do in terms of running a live site service? How much telemetry do you need? How do you design for operations right from the beginning? If I had one piece of advice to go back in time, other than lottery tickets, because I'd start there, for both our internal services, because we are not immune, that we have had some internal learning experiences as well as to our larger customers, is to log every single internal or external transaction. If I cross a process boundary, I will log that. I will capture it, and I will report on it. I will capture the application context, who logged it. I will capture the host context, where did I log it from. I will capture the timing information. Remember that ridiculously long timeout issue I showed earlier? At the time, the only thing that was logged was service in, service out from the HTTP, from the first, basically the IIS web record. So what we saw was a number of IIS records spiking from an average of 20 milliseconds up to 10,000, 50,000 milliseconds. But there was no apparent pattern, because it's a queuing mechanism. If you get stuck in line behind somebody, it doesn't matter if you've got one chocolate bar. Your end-to-end latency is going to be how long it took to get the person in front of you out of the queue plus your time. We were not logging the individual callouts to the external service. So the only way we resolved that was with psychic debugging, as opposed to, hey, this particular service has suddenly spiked. It's called by these guys. Here's the problem. You absolutely must log all of this stuff. And you may be thinking, well, that's expensive. Well, it's less expensive than getting run down with a truck. So you have to instrument your code to make these callouts. And the right place to do this is in those client libraries. Don't make your developers do this automatically. If I have to go and manually put logging code into everything, I'm probably not going to do it. But if I call an API and it does it for me, that's generally a path to wisdom. Plus, it means I can optimize and actually do the logging efficiently. And again, I need to consolidate the logs to a central system for health monitoring, troubleshooting, and diagnostics. I have a pretty simple it's one of those simple, hard philosophies. I should be able to diagnose and troubleshoot a live production system with only the logs that are automatically captured for determining a service or dependency failure. If I have an all-up code failure, like a bug that I didn't catch, I may need to connect a debugger to check code tracing. But I don't want to go there, because again, if I have 1,000 servers deployed and I don't have good logging, all right, I have remote desktop and a debugger, and 1,000 servers and someone breathing down my neck. Usually not a good situation. So log, 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 log. So let's look at a piece of actual code. So this is from a pattern library that my team is getting ready to publish on CodePlex. This shows some, not saying they're the best or the only patterns or the only approaches, but just here are some boilerplate code that we've used in some pretty large-scale production systems to capture key information. So this is just a part of a data access library that wraps a SQL command in a couple of things. It wraps it in timing, it wraps it in retries, and we do a couple of things. So we capture the timing and the context, we capture conceptual errors. Who has ever done log exception.toString? I've done it. My bad. Why is that a terribly bad idea? Sorry? Inner exceptions? Did I hear inner exceptions? I thought I heard inner exceptions, a few nods. I don't get inner exceptions, I don't get context, I don't get extrapolation. Exception to string is great, except for when that absolutely critical piece of information wasn't in there. So I generally, and if everyone's doing it differently, that's a problem. That's why I like logging facades that just take an exception object and then you unroll it via policy. And you can see some of the same things kind of flowing in here. Other thing is, absolutely you want your logging library to be asynchronous. Any logging library that does a direct write to disk is fundamentally broken and will not scale. You absolutely have to have an asynchronous store and forward based mechanism. Does anyone use trace source, system diagnostics trace source in their applications? Couple hands. My condolences. I'll explain why I said that. So when I think about what I want in a logging library, I want something that's fast, extensible, and gives me an opportunity for structured tracing and the ability to point to multiple targets without tying me to a specific implementation. I generally always recommend the use of some logging facade, some layer of abstraction. I don't care if you use trace source under the hood, even though you can't update it dynamically in an Azure environment because it's hard-coded to web config and app config. Nlog, log4net, I really don't care, as long as you're not using any of them directly so that you can go and change. I've got one customer that has 37,000 lines of trace source code in their application. And trace source is purely unstructured. In order to move to an area where they can actually log more things in production and make sense of it, they need to move to structured tracing, ETW. they have to go and change 37,000 lines of code. This is going to cost a couple of $1 million for them to do, as opposed to going into their logging facade and plugging in a different implementation. It's one of these things that's incredibly sticky. I can change targets, I can change config, I can change all of these things after the fact, but changing the lines of code that are baked into my app is incredibly expensive. So for capturing and working with this information, I've got lots of options. I can use Windows Azure Diagnostics. There's some scalability issues, but you can work around it through config. But if you want to pay for it, if you want to trade dev cost for convenience, which is usually a pretty good trade, we've got stuff like New Relic and AppDynamics and Loggly and Opstera. They can shortcut you from bake this in behind your logging facade and have a full end-to-end experience. The key thing is, what are the questions that I need to be able to answer on a continuous and a reactive basis in order to run my site efficiently and effectively? You should have that list of questions, and the values you capture to get that are not always the obvious ones. Who captures CPU from their deployed servers? I know, I ask a lot of really dumb rhetorical questions that I already know the answer to. It's just a dialogue device. So why is CPU a terribly not useful metric for monitoring a web server? Everyone's looking like, he's crazy, CPU is the first thing you measure. Well, maybe not. Exactly. So yeah, it's just one aspect, but even more importantly, it's actually a dependent measure. CPU is a measure of headroom. It's a measure of how many resources are available, CPU, memory, network being the key ones, and disk I/O to a lesser extent. It's not actually the most important measure in an IIS server, though. Remember back when we talked about the queuing model? The most important metric is that queue full? Is it about to be full? And is my system about to tip over? I have seen that blocking queue problem. I've seen a web server that is completely stogged, running 3% CPU, 8% memory, and like 1.5% network. There are dependent and independent metrics. The independent ones tell you how much actual headroom you have. Your dependent ones will tell you how much resources you have available to fulfill load. They're both important, but that's why you need to think about, what question am I trying to answer? And if the question is, can I put more load through this system? And it's an IIS-based web server. The first question is, what's the queue depth? If it's anything other than zero, I'm in a lot of trouble. Or I just need to roll out more servers. Okay. So just a quick recap. Instrumentation for production logging. If you do not capture it, it did not happen. You should be able to diagnose and determine system behavior from the telemetry that you are always capturing. Not a special debug build, but the stuff that's always there. You want to know every single service call between, once you leave the process boundary, you want to know it. And you want the ability to dial up for specific debug experiences. And if you use Trace Source with web config or app config, you cannot do this in an Azure deployed PaaS service. Because when I take an Azure package and deploy it to a service, it's immutable. It's a non-modifiable package. And because the way system configuration works, it's looking at that hard-coded value. So just something to watch out for. I'm just going to say one more thing on operations and where we usually see most systems breaking, and then I'll just take some questions off on the side. All right. This is a big bunch of gobbledygook about ALM. Application lifecycle management. The human element is usually the most critical piece in any system. So normally when I have a conversation with customers, it'll go along the lines of, I'll get hammered on, what are your processes? How are you going to guarantee me uptime? How are you going to do this? How are you going to do that? And I usually pull back a little bit and go, I am more than happy to talk about how to build a highly available service in Azure in terms of your coding. But the most important thing, and the thing that you will screw up the most, is if you do not have strong DevOps processes in place, you will push out bad code, you will push out bad config, and you will drop your service in production. And how can I say this? We have the data from the industry, and we, Microsoft, we have done this. Amazon has done this. Every large service provider, if you go and you look at the data, I don't have the exact statistical distribution, almost every massive outage is caused by human error. Let's look at updating config. Does the ability to modify with a text pad, basically a notepad-like experience for configuration. Terrify anybody else in this room. Thank you. This is the scariest thing I could see in production. The ability to live edit. It's great for agility. It's also great for blowing stuff up. Once I do this, there's no undo button. Configuration and code are the same thing for a production service. You must treat configuration as a versioned, iterative entity because your code cannot run without its config. So if you go and you push up a live change and you don't have a way to roll back, what's the technical term? Yeah, you're screwed. I have had customers ask me for, and they had very good reasons for asking this. I want a system that gives me global, simultaneous production rollouts of our new code. And I look at them and go, are you sure? Let me tell you a story about how when we did this and it didn't end so well. At scale, the only testing is testing in production. The only way you will find out that you have made the subtle errors that are comprised of a bunch of different failure points is in production. You generally find out you have a misconfiguration when you've rolled it out. So iterative rollouts, AB, the ability to fall back, these are critically important. And they require substantial investments in your people and your processes and your approaches to rolling out live site services. This is the, if you leave with nothing else from this hour, this is the one. And that the number one cause of a massive public in the news system failures is the human element doing a global rollout and having a, oh, moment. So investments in ALM are worth it. Automation, audit trails, just the ability to know what you've pushed out, how much you've pushed it out to, the ability to see in near real time how it's working, how it's behaving, and the ability to continue the rollout or roll back from there. All right, thus ends my formal pontificating. I'm just going to skip a couple other things. We've got some great white papers out on the internet that cover this in excruciating more detail. I've essentially condensed about 6 hours of hands-on stuff into 1 hour of rambling. Hopefully that was reasonably useful and gives you kind of some... Occasionally when I kind of give this spiel, some people are like, ooh, I'm terrified. Respectably so. I can understand that. A lot of what I'm talking about really only comes into play when you're running at severe scale. The operation stuff doesn't. You can shoot yourself in the foot with 3 users. But normally, if you only have 3 users, you can call them all personally and send them whiskey and apologize. So don't take this as a, oh my God, it's incredibly difficult to deploy large-scale services. Well, actually, it is. If you're rolling out stuff to millions of people, in public with continuous availability, it's a set of muscles that needs to get built up and exercised. It takes time, there will be mistakes, but it's a pretty compelling way to be able to reach very large numbers of people without capitalized investments and the ability to grow up and just really kind of have a profound impact. There's just a few things you need to learn along the way, and we are doing our best to kind of get that guidance out there and share some of what we've learned, some of the battle scars that we've incurred, both internally and in conjunction with some of our customers. So thanks for letting me borrow an hour of your life, and I'll just hang off on the side while the next presenter is prepping up.